It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we look back on the 60th anniversary of a pivotal event in the American Civil Rights Movement, the Montgomery bus boycott.
First, the Pentagon announced yesterday that it will now allow women to serve in all military combat roles.
The historic decision opens up about 220,000 potential jobs to women. Here's what Defense Secretary Ash Carter had to say about the importance of opening up these jobs for women in the military.
To succeed in our mission of national defense, we cannot afford to cut ourselves off from half the country's talents and skills. We have to take full advantage of every individual who can meet our standards.
That decision comes after the military began to open up combat jobs to women in January of 2013, and yesterday's announcement makes it official. Joining us now is Bridget Nelson, an Army veteran and Assistant Veterans Service Officer in Dane County. Bridget, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
And Bridget, this is being seen as a historic decision by the U.S. military. What does this day mean to women who've served and the women who will serve in the U.S. Armed Forces?
Well, I do believe it's a welcomed opportunity for change in the military. So many women view this as a leap forward. Nowadays, there's really no demarcation for combat roles or frontline, if you will. Women are exposed to IEDs. You know, we have been playing those roles for a very long time. So this is kind of an acknowledgement of the job women do in the military.
And what was your first reaction yesterday when you heard this news?
My first reaction, there are pros and cons to this. And my first reaction was I was very happy to hear it. But I did feel that there are pros and cons, and I felt that, you know, that women should at least have an opportunity to elect to be in these roles, certain roles such as infantry. But there are others that will welcome it, that will be very good at it, that will surpass all standards. So there is that.
And you mentioned that there were cons. What cons are you thinking of?
Well, I believe for myself, when I thought about it, I know that I would not be physically able to do some of the jobs. For example, you know, there were two ladies that graduated Ranger School, and it was an absolute leap for women in the military. But for me, I didn't think that I would be physically able to do it. And there are some women that will feel like that. And they'll be introduced to roles that they're not necessarily capable of doing.
Well, the military has said that it will ensure that the women who move into some of these roles that were quote-unquote off-limits before, that they will be ensured to be fit for that job. So, assumingly, the same process will be applied for a man or a woman. Do you see any problem with that?
They have to meet the standards. They definitely have to meet the standards to be able to join these, participate in these roles.
And how have women served in the military in the past in these combat roles? You said this isn't anything that's terribly new, and yet there were 220,000 jobs that have been off the table for women. So how have women been involved in combat so far?
Well, women are pilots. Women are engineers. They're military polices, mechanics. So women have been doing those roles that are normally sometimes seen as male roles, but they're not. You know, we want to mirror what the civilian world has been like. Women are police officers, firefighters, and so forth. So I really see this as an opportunity to be on the same sheet as women in the civilian world.
We're talking right now with Army veteran Bridget Nelson, talking about the Pentagon's decision to open up all combat roles to women in the U.S. military. And Marine General Joe Dunford has come out against putting women in combat roles in the past, and he said that all male infantry units perform better than integrated units. Is that, to your knowledge, a common argument in the military?
Yes, absolutely. There is resentment sometimes, and it is a common argument that women don't meet the same physical they're not physically capable. There are certain jobs in the military that has certain demands that women, you know, women carry equipment, heavy equipment, and, you know, but there are times when people believe that, you know, some of the men think that if the women aren't able to do these type of jobs, they will have to pick up the slack. You know, and so those are some of the arguments that I'm familiar with.
Now, President Obama said earlier today that he trusts the military to implement the changes, and this is a quote, in a responsible manner that maintains military readiness and the unparalleled professionalism and strength of our armed forces. Do you expect there to be uniform compliance with this, or would you expect there to be some dissent, maybe not something that's very outward, but some sort of feet dragging on this, maybe behind closed doors? And are you there, Bridget Nelson? I think we lost you, Bridget Nelson. We're going to redial right now. We're talking about the decision from the Pentagon to open up all combat roles to women in the U.S. military. And Bridget Nelson is an Army veteran. She's also an assistant veteran service officer in Dane County. And we're working on getting her back. That decision coming down just yesterday. And we're going to see if we can check back in with her and get her on the line to talk more about that decision. President Obama behind it made that announcement. We had Defense Secretary making that announcement yesterday. And you can let us know what you think about that idea on the Central Time Facebook page. And Bridget, are you back with us?
Yes, I am.
Great.
And I'm sorry, I missed part of the question. I'm not sure what happened. We had that disconnection.
Right. Wondering if you expect there to be uniform compliance with this decision, or whether you expect there to be still some reluctance behind closed doors.
Oh, absolutely. There will be reluctance. There are, you know, people are usually, there's always going to be resistance to change. I had an opportunity to speak to three veterans that came into the office today, and I asked them what they thought about it. And these were men, and they thought that there were pros and cons, and I think they all shared the same view that there are women who will excel at these roles, but then there are women who that don't want to be involved with these roles. So I think they all shared, and there will be resistance to change, as there has been in, you know, various different changes in the military.
As a veteran yourself, just to follow up on that argument that you've been hearing about, there may be some women who don't excel in these roles. Why would there be a woman in a role that she wasn't fit enough to fill if she was also reluctant to be there? Would that be a scenario that you think would realistically happen?
Yes, I do. I believe that there's not going to be, women are not going to be able to elect where they want to go. So, for example, I think that for infantry roles and so forth, there will be, I really believe that there will be a test. Women will be tested more so to prove themselves when they're selected for these roles. And I believe that, I don't know if you guys ever have, I know there's the role with, you know, I'm sorry, I completely forgot what I was.
We were talking about the roles a woman might be in the military, and whether it would be reasonable to expect that she might be in a role like this that she maybe wasn't equipped to do.
Yes, there are going to be those cases. There are going to be those cases where a woman might not be equipped. Say she might be past the physical guidelines that, you know, that the military is looking for. But, you know, there are, you know, mental, problems mentally as well. Being able to deal for days with certain things, such as not really being able to, for lack of a better thought, is not being able to shower for days, not being able to, although that does happen right now. You know, there's no demarcation, like I said, as far as front lines go. You know, we're all there.
And Bridget, before I let you go, is this, do you think, still a big day for women in the military?
Absolutely. Yes, this is a very big day and a leap for change, really good change in the military.
Bridget, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That was Army veteran Bridget Nelson talking about the Pentagon's decision to open up all combat roles to women in the U.S. military. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
60 years ago this weekend, organizers started a bus boycott in Montgomery, Alabama over segregation policies on the public transit system. The event was triggered by the arrest of Rosa Parks on December 1st when she refused a bus driver's order for black passengers to give up their seats and move to the back of the bus.
Will Jones joins us now for a look at the movement behind the boycott and its place in history. He's a professor of history at UW-Madison and author of The March on Washington, Jobs, Freedom, and the Forgotten History of Civil Rights. Will, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, at some point in my youth, I know I learned about these events, and the story was, and so often is told as though Rosa Parks, just this random tired woman who sparked this spontaneous movement. Can you tell us more, though, about the organization that went into those boycotts and how Rosa Parks fit into all of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, interestingly, Rosa Parks is really kind of at the center of the myth, I think, around this events. The idea that she was just this tired, often seen as sort of a tired old woman. She actually wasn't very old at the time. And the idea that she really just didn't want to get up on the bus. She had worked a long day, which actually, you know, there's elements of truth to that. She said that she wasn't planning on starting that bus boycott that day, but that tiny part of it really misses a really fascinating long story in which she was actually a lifetime political activist by this time. She was very centrally involved in building the NAACP in Montgomery. And she was part of a group of activists who had been actively talking about and planning a bus boycott for years in response to the treatment, the brutality, particularly that black women faced on these buses in Montgomery. So she wasn't actually planning it that day, but she was planning for a very long time something like this, and this sort of sparked off something that was in the works.
And talk about the movement and the organizations and maybe some of the people who was involved in this long organizational effort that got sparked by that day's events.
Right. Well, as I said, Rosa Parks was an activist in the Montgomery branch of the NAACP. That was led by her and a man named Edie Nixon. Edie Nixon was a Pullman porter, and he was a member of a union, which was an all-black union. It was the largest all-black union in the country at the time. And through that union, he had got to know black activists all over the country, including the leader of that union, who was A. Philip Randolph, who was the principal nationally known civil rights leader at the time. Both Rosa Parks and Edie Nixon in the 1940s had become very active in a national movement that A. Philip Randolph led to launch a March on Washington that was called off at the last minute and became the basis for the famous March on Washington in 1963. So they were really, they had also been involved in protesting voting rights restrictions. So they had led campaigns to protest restrictions on voter registration. So they were part of this very important NAACP branch, but there were other political organizations. Perhaps the second most important was the Women's Political Council, which was a group primarily of black women who were school teachers and college professors who were really the principal people in getting the word out to the broader community about the boycott. So they actually printed up pamphlets, thousands of copies of pamphlets, and handed it out to their members, who handed it out to their students, who brought them home to their parents. And that's really the principal way in which they spread news of the boycott.
The social media of the time, in a way. Now, this boycott lasted over a year. How did it keep going that long? It's one thing to start something like this, another to sustain it for that long.
That's right. Well, I think, you know, obviously having these organizations that were able to sustain the effort over a long period of time, other organizations were also built in the process. You know, there's really interesting ongoing research about this. Jean Theo Harris wrote a fabulous biography of Rosa Parks detailing some of this. Danielle McGuire, who was a graduate student here at UW-Madison, wrote a really fascinating book that details some of this. Another historian, Pramila Nadison, has recently written about the role that domestic workers played in this boycott. she focuses on a woman named Georgia Gilmore, who actually built an organization of domestic workers to help raise money. These were extremely poor women, but they pooled their wages to raise money for things like food, for transportation. They have eventually put together an alternative transportation system that consisted primarily of cars that people could call and get rides to work if they wanted, if they needed. These sort of networks, these social networks, were put together in some ways building on longstanding networks, but also in the spur of the moment to sustain the protest.
Ultimately, the protests were successful. Courts ordered the desegregation of public transit there. Violent backlash after that. Can you talk about some of what happened after victory?
Yeah, well, I mean, during the boycott, the backlash was immediate. Almost immediately, Rosa Parks was fired from her job at a downtown department store. Edie Nixon and Martin Luther King, who became the leader of the movement, their houses were bombed repeatedly during the boycott. And then after the boycott, there was a rash of attacks on people who rode the buses and. This was throughout the South. This was a moment in which we saw the mobilization of the civil rights movement, which I think we're very familiar with, but also this backlash in the form of the Ku Klux Klan and the White Citizens Councils.
Talking to Will Jones, professor of history at UW-Madison, on the 60th anniversary this weekend of the Montgomery bus boycotts. And we're talking about this now, Will, 60 years later. This is one episode in a much wider civil rights movement, of course. Why do we look back on this one? Why do we look back on the bus boycott as such a significant pivotal moment that lasted over a year?
Well, I think for a number of reasons. I mean, this was a movement that gained national and international attention, in part because it was sustained for so long and was so effective. It was the movement that brought Martin Luther King into the national spotlight and really made him a movement. In some ways, people like Rosa Parks and Edie Nixon, Joanne Robinson, who headed the Women's Political Council, they really selected Martin Luther King to be their spokesperson. He was a young minister who was new to town. In some ways, they chose him because he wasn't involved in the sort of internal factions in the town. And so we remember this because this was the moment in which he rose to national stardom. It was also the first time in which the strategies of nonviolent civil disobedience were effectively put into place in a really sustained way to turn this to make this an effective movement.
And the bus boycott met its goals. It won. There were other civil rights victories, but 60 years later, we're still talking about issues of race, and we're still seeing protests, campuses, big cities in particular, around the country. Are there lessons, do you think, from the bus boycott that that protesters might be learning today or should be paying attention to today?
Right. Well, I think in some ways, you know, while the boycott itself, it won in terms of a court decision in the state of Alabama, it really opened up a long-standing battle, really over the legality of legalized segregation that would continue through for the next 10 years until the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 65. So in some ways, I think, and in many ways, the questions both about unequal treatment in public, about brutality, about these sort of interpersonal relationships that were really at the focus of this protest that Rosa Parks launched on the bus, I think stay with us today. So in some ways, I think one lesson is to think about this as part of an ongoing struggle. I think it's also important that we recognize that the sort of flashpoints like the boycott, like the marches, even like Rosa Parks's act of defiance are really just the surface phenomenon that are underlaid by, in many ways, years and decades of organization and network building.
Do we, living now in the 21st century, have the patience for that kind of long-term organizing and network building when we can just have people meet up at a protest, say, on social media?
Well, I think we do have the patience. I think we've seen that. I mean, a lot of the organizations, the NAACP, certainly, that were that played an important role in that movement still are with us today, and people are still forming them and organizing them. I think we've seen the birth of new organizations here in Madison, Young Gifted and Black, an organization that was built, you know, in the spur of the moment, and in some ways, like the movements that emerged out of the boycott, you know, have the possibility to sustain a movement for a much longer period of time.
Will, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Will Jones. He's professor of history at UW-Madison. He's author of the book, The March on Washington, Jobs, Freedom, and the Forgotten History of Civil Rights. We've been looking at the 60th anniversary this weekend of the Montgomery, Alabama bus boycott, viewed as a pivotal event in civil rights history here in the United States.
Coming up, a look at the power of sharing a meal on Food Friday. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Tragedy struck the Sikh temple in Oak Creek, Wisconsin on August 5th, 2012, when six members of the community were killed by a white supremacist.
Today on Food Friday, we talk about the community meals that have been part of the Sikh faith and how they helped the community heal from the terrible violence they endured. These Lunger meals are featured in a new documentary called Off the Menu, Asian America. And here's a listen to the introduction to that episode.
From New York, I head back to the Midwest, to Milwaukee, or more precisely, a suburb south of the city. The scenery is really familiar. Lots of trees, lots of space, and not many Asians. There's a community here of Indian Americans who are of the Sikh faith. Although many Americans aren't familiar with Sikhism, it's the fifth largest religion in the world. I had heard about a Sikh tradition in which temples host weekly communal meals open to anyone who wants to join. It's called Lunger, and it's an integral part of the faith.
Joining us now are Donald Young and Navdeep Singh Gill. Donald is the director of programs at the Center for Asian American Media, which produced Off the Menu, Asian America, along with KQED. Donald, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
And also with us is Navdeep Singh Gill. He is currently a student at UW-Milwaukee. Within the Sikh community, he's a youth mentor at the Sikh Temple in Oak Creek, helping them to overcome obstacles, including healing after the 2012 mass shooting. Navdeep, thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having us.
Well, Donald, we'll start with you. Can you tell us how Off the Menu, Asian America documentary, how it came to be?
Sure. So we are in San Francisco, CAM, the Center for Asian American Media. We fund and produce work for public television. And we had been noticing with KQED that food had become, you know, really a cultural touch point for cultural expression. And we found that a lot of Asian Americans were starting to participate in that space. But for us, we really wanted to deepen the conversation and have food be an entree, so to speak, into our community and how we intersect with Asian America in America in general.
And Don, Asian American covers a lot of ground, a lot of different cultures, places of origin, and cuisines. How did you pick topics to focus in on here?
Well, that's really to credit of Grace Lee, the filmmaker who's produced the show. Grace is really one of the most experienced, respected filmmakers in our community. And, you know, she really worked on this, developed the storylines for a good year and a half, and really tried to hone in on different stories that would really illustrate the depth and sort of richness of our community. And, you know, obviously she really wanted to focus on particular parts of the of America that we may not have explored much through public television.
And Navi, we'll go to you now. Now, the Lunger community meals are featured in the documentary that we're talking about now. And because they're so closely tied to your faith, can you tell us a little bit about the Sikh religion and how these Lunger meals fit into that picture?
Yes. So Sikhism was found approximately 400 years ago. And at that time, other religions existed. So Sikhism was quite new. And one thing that really brought people to Sikhism was the fact that people were able to have a community meal together. You know, langar is prepared and consumed by the community together. And most importantly, it's open to all, regardless of your race, religion, economic status, or any other bias. And in addition to that, it's open 24/7, 365 days a week. You know, so essentially, it became a soup kitchen to anybody who wanted to join and break bread. And in the ingredients of any Lunger meal consist of all vegetarian items. You know, so for Hindus that, you know, aren't able to eat beef, or for Muslims who may be may not be able to eat pork, you know, this was a meal that they could all sit together and eat. And after the shooting on August 5th, you know, this was something that really brought us together.
And Navi, this shooting, as I understand it, happened as this Lunger meal was being prepared. And watching this documentary, it seems like it was really important to the community there that you wouldn't close off after that shooting. You would make a renewed effort to be open to the community, in part by making sure this Lunger tradition kept on stronger than ever. Why was it so important to get back to that daily meal?
So one key motto that we all embraced was turning tragedy into triumph. You know, every Sunday morning we prepared Lunger to make sure it was fresh for everybody that came to pray on Sunday. And that morning, to be attacked while all these people were serving their community, we felt the only way to respond was to come back together stronger and more resilient than before. And In doing that, what we tried to do was not only bring other Sikhs together from around the community, to also include other people of different faiths, different community backgrounds, to really show them what Sikhism is. And we did that through Lunger.
We're talking right now with Donald Young and Navi Singh Gill for our Food Friday today, talking about Off the Menu, Asian America. It's a documentary, and we're zeroing in on part of that documentary, which takes a look at the Wisconsin Sikh community, in particular the Oak Creek community, where the mass shooting occurred in 2012. But looking at the Lunger tradition there of a community meal, opening the doors to everyone who wants to come and serving a meal that anyone can partake of. And Navi, I know that you were at the time, you were talking about how afterwards another Sikh temple in the area came and brought Lunger to your temple to keep that tradition going. Why was that such a moving thing for you?
Yes, yeah, so the day of the shooting, and that happened in the late morning, but, you know, nobody really knew what was going on, and we were across the street at a bowling alley, basically waiting to hear news and to find out, you know, what the impact of this tragedy was. And in that time, as we were there for nearly 12 hours just waiting, the other local Sikh temple located in Brookfield decided to bring their Lunger to us. You know, so even in the time of such uncertainty and you know, a time of sadness and not knowing, you know, what the outcome was going to be, the one thing we could still share was, you know, a meal among ourselves with our community members. You know, but it wasn't just, you know, the Sikh temple from Brookfield. You know, even the Red Cross, you know, they brought you know, sandwiches and other food that we could share. You know, so just the fact that, you know, we're able to break bread together was essential, even at that time of uncertainty.
We'll learn a little more about Lunger and get into some of the food. But before we do that, Donald, I wanted to ask you, this is a dramatic example of how important food is to this Asian American community in Oak Creek. Did you see similar examples in your documentary and your work of the central role of food in Asian American cultures?
Absolutely. You know, for Oak Creek, the story was, you know, the ability to explore how food can heal, right? But in addition, you know, there are other segments in the film where food in Hawaii is about reclaiming culture and reclaiming history and be able to express oneself through food. And then the other stories really get to the core of what is authenticity, what is personal expression, how does family, you know, how's really family and all of these discovered through the experience of creating meals together, right? So for us, it was really an amazing opportunity to begin to explore the breadth of family and food together in a way that hopefully, you know, communities outside of the Asian American community could really connect with.
And let's talk a little bit about the food now. We'll get deeper into this in just a bit. But Navi, what are some of the typical components of a Lunger meal?
So because Lunger is a meal made for the common man, it is a meal that consists of very simple ingredients and not too complex of a process to be able to prepare Lunger. And some of the most common parts of the meal include samosas, which are basically a tortilla filled with potatoes as appetizers prior to the main meal. You know, and it also consists of, you know, higher fat or higher calorie foods because people are, you know, coming from, in the older times, people were coming from far away, you know, as the Lunger was opening, you know, so this was meant to serve people, you know, who still had a ways to go. And in addition to that, roti, which is basically a tortilla, is a bread served with all Lunger. And in addition, there are multiple items such as lentil beans or other sorts of beans and vegetables that are served with Lunger.
We're talking with Donald Young and Navi Singh Gill about the off-the-menu Asian America documentary and especially the Wisconsin Sikh community that is featured in it.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How do you see community meals bringing people together? Have you participated in a gathering around food that helped people come together in ways that they might not have otherwise? Have you ever been present? Have you ever had one of these Lunger meals that we're talking about? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And you'll find a couple recipes for commonly served foods at these Lunger meals, roti and chana masala. We'll be back with Donald and Navi in just a minute. First, a look at the news with Kristen Durst. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation now with Donald Young and Navi Singh Gill about the new documentary, Off the Menu, Asian America. And we're talking especially about the Sikh temple in Oak Creek and its community meals that are featured in that documentary. They're called Lunger.
And we want to hear from you. Have you shared in a community meal that has brought people together in this or another community? What do you think it is about food that can create community, build relationships? Are community meals a part of your faith or your ethnic heritage? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Navi, going back to those meals, now you mentioned samosas. Those are very popular worldwide, and they're prepared, it sounds like, a special way, a little slightly easier than making the pastry dough yourself. How do you make them at the temple?
So essentially, the basic way to make a samosa is you actually buy pre-prepared flour tortillas, and the process of making them is you essentially first prepare a stuffing, similar to that of Thanksgiving, but more heavily based with potatoes, peas, and any additional spices. And that's where the variance comes. You're allowed to experiment with a number of different spices. And using the tortillas, you essentially you cut each tortilla in half, creating a half circle. And you're able to form the tortilla into a cone shape, kind of like an ice cream cone. And that's when you stuff the potato stuffing into the samosa, and you use kind of a flour paste to close the samosa, and then they're fried. So it's very similar to empanada, where it's fried, deep fried, and they're then served with a multitude of sauces, whether it's tamarind sauce or mint sauce or even ketchup.
And Donald, as I understand it, well, one of the things I liked about this video, the documentary, first of all, is seeing the community not just eating together, but cooking together. All the mostly women in the kitchen making these massive amounts of samosas and roti and all the other foods. Is that a common theme that you encountered in this documentary? Not just communal eating here, but the community coming together to make the food.
Absolutely, we have screened the film in festivals throughout the country, and it's interesting. In a recent event, one of the attendees commented on how the food is, or the film itself, the visual that she was really left with was hands and preparation, and how food is so much about each person contributing, you know, producing food together, and really the communal effort of actually making food together, right? And we were really struck by that because I know for Grace, the filmmaker, she hadn't necessarily intended visually to show that at such personal level, but we were struck by that comment that really it is, you know, people, you know, together creating meals, which is such a beautiful part of the experience, right?
And Avi, we'll go back to you now to ask you about one of the recipes that we have up right now on the Central Time Facebook page, and that is for roti, which is a kind of bread. How is it prepared at the temple?
Yes, so roti is essentially made from wheat, and that's a main grain staple of Punjab, India. You know, Punjab is known for its farming, and wheat being the most plentiful. You know, and roti is can be compared to a tortilla. Essentially, what it is, you take 2 cups of flour and 1 cup of water to knead the dough and any additional oil that's needed. You know, and that amount can serve about 4 to 6 people. And essentially, it's, you know, baking bread, but it doesn't have any rising agent, so it's a flat bread, but it's very soft. You know, and it's fully cooked, and you essentially use that roti as a, you know, as a bread to eat your vegetables with, or eat your soup or beans with. You know, so it's served with all longer meals, and you know, in all Indian households, there's, you know, if you don't have anything else, you'll always have roti.
Talking to Navi Singh Gill and Donald Young, talking about the documentary Off the Menu, Asian America, and an event at Sikh temples around the world, including here in Wisconsin, in Oak Creek, the Lunger Meal. And Navi, this isn't just about building community within the Sikh faith here. You mentioned earlier that the people from the community are welcome. Why is that an important part of the Lunger tradition?
So, you know, back when Sikhism was first founded, you know, India was dealing with issues of, you know, the caste system and people being segregated and discriminated against. And Lunger became this very important and very vital aspect of Sikhism, where anybody and everybody, you know, regardless of, you know, if you're the king of your village or if you're a peasant, you know, you were able to come to this meal and all join together in both preparing this and eating it. And in addition to that, Langar was meant to be a humbling experience. You know, that's why when you go to a Sikh temple and you know, you go to the kitchen, you won't see, you know, tables and chairs. Because in our tradition, we sit on the ground and eat langar as it both humbles you and you break bread with your fellow community members.
How many people typically come for langar?
We have anywhere from 300 to 500 every week.
Wow.
The Sikh population is growing quite nicely in southeastern Wisconsin, you know, and to think that you prepare that much food every given Sunday, and you know, they prepare fair amounts throughout the week as well for, you know, people that drop by every day. You know, and in addition to that, I would like to extend an invitation to everybody listening on behalf of the Sikh Temple to join us on a Sunday and experience this for yourself. You know, if anything, you know, you'll leave with a free meal and enjoy some samosas.
And Donald, before we let the two of you go, how can we see the documentary Off the Menu?
Yeah, the film is going to premiere nationally on PBS on December 8th, although folks should check the local listings with the PBS station, but we're excited that it's going to be premiering nationally on PBS next week.
Excellent. And Navi, people wanted to take you up on that very kind offer. What time would they typically show up?
So our services run throughout the weekend, but the main langar meal is served from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m., you know, so visitors can stop by any time, and we will be more than happy, you know, to show you around and, you know, to give you a nice meal.
All right. Well, thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
We've been speaking there with Donald Young, Director of Programs at the Center for Asian Media, which produced Off the Menu, Asian America, along with KQED. Also joining us there, Navdeep Singh Gill, a member of the Oak Creek, Wisconsin Sikh Temple community.
Weekday mornings from 6 to 9, it's the Joy Cardine Show. Monday morning at 6, Joy looks at news that car sales are up and gets advice for buying a new car in 2016. That's coming up Monday morning at 6 on the Joy Cardine Show.
Well, today's a holiday of sorts, one that's close to our hearts here at Central Time. Turns out it's National Cookie Day.
We like all manner of sweetened baked goods around here. Cookies are near the top of the list in tough competition with donuts, pie. Pie's good, too. A cake. Brownies.
Okay,
I like.
And getting back to Cookie Day.
Right, yeah.
Cookie Day. With the holiday baking season around the corner, it's a good time to think about our favorites, right? And to celebrate. So we ran out to a store today, Rob and I, and got some cookies for the Central Time crew.
Yeah, white chocolate macadamia nut cookies. Shared them around. They're pretty good, right?
Yeah, it's hard to find a bad cookie, right? It's like pizza. It's hard to find a bad pizza or a bad cookie.
I wish both of those things were true. I've had bad ones. But no, these are good. And we have sort of a tradition. I used to get these big cookies at a place next door just for myself. Then we started sharing them, which is good, because that meant I ate a half a cookie less each day.
But then when you think about it, it meant each of us were eating 2.5 giant cookies a week.
Yeah, so we did dial it back a little, but those are really good. Chocolate chip. And the holidays are coming up.
Right.
Sugar cookie with frosting. One of my holiday favorites. You?
Oatmeal raisin. You have to love oatmeal raisin.
I don't.
Well, you're allergic to cinnamon.
Right, and that kind of kills it for me. And I don't know. I don't like raisins and baked goods that much either.
No. Well, I don't know. To each his own. That's the thing about cookies. There is a cookie for everyone.
Yeah. Well, tweet us your favorite cookie on National Cookie Day at Central Time WPR. This is Central Time.
C is for cookie, that's good enough for me. C is for cookie, that's good enough for me. C is for cookie, that's good enough for me. Oh, cookie starts with C. Oh.